Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 401, titled The Day of the Cynics. This is being recorded on March 3rd of the year 2003. Now, we're going to return to the subject that we were covering in side one of the program, and that is the article by Professor Peter Dale Scott from his website, and the full URL will be in the annotated in the description for this program. The article is called Bush's Deep Reasons for War on Iraq, Oil, Petrodollars, and the OPEC Euro Question. And this is an aspect of the confrontation between the U.S. and Iraq that is not getting discussed. I think there's certainly far more to it than this. But one of the aspects of the whole petroleum question concerns the fact that Iraq had become the first OPEC nation to convert its reserves from dollars to euros and to begin pricing its oil in euros. That's discussed in a section of Professor Peter Dale Scott's article, The Unstated U.S. Goal of Preserving Dollar Hegemony Against Competition from the Euro. And this, again, is to be seen in the context of a larger geopolitical confrontation between the European Monetary Union and the U.S., and to a lesser extent Britain, what I have called Germania versus Anglo-Saxonia. And then within that is yet another struggle, which I believe to be quite literally a continuation of World War II, with the underground Reich using the various Muslim populations of the Middle East and the Earth Island, as the geopoliticians called it, as proxy warriors, ultimately aiming either to bankrupt the United States by pushing it into excessive military expenditures and thereby weakening it economically and or ultimately destroying it or at least discrediting it internationally. Skipping down in Professor Scott's article, Iraq was one of the first OPEC countries in 2000 to convert its reserves from dollars to euros. At the time, a commentator for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, predicted that Saddam's political act, quote, will cost Iraq millions in lost revenue, unquote. In fact, Iraq has profited handsomely from the 17% gain in the value of the euro against the dollar in that time. Other countries have gradually been climbing onto the euro bandwagon. An article in the Iran Financial News of August 25th of 2002 revealed that more than half of Iran's Forex reserve fund assets had been converted from dollars to euros. In 2002, China began diversifying its currency reserves away from dollars into euros. According to Businessweek of February 17th of 2003, Russia's central bank in the past year has doubled its euro holdings to 20% of its $48 billion foreign exchange reserves. And for a very good reason, according to its first deputy chairman, Oleg Vyugin, quote, returns on dollar instruments are very low now. Other currency instruments pay more, unquote. Businessweek continues, quote, the story is the same across the globe. Money traders say that institutions as diverse as the Bank of Canada, People's Bank of China, and Central Bank of Taiwan are giving more weight to the European currency. By the end of this year, they predict, the euro could account for 20% of global foreign currency reserves, which today amounts to a cool $2.4 trillion. Little more than a year ago, the euro made up just 10%. Quote, no one is saying that the euro is going to replace the dollar as the premier reserve currency, says Michael Clowiter, a currency strategist at West LB Research in London, again quoting, but it will increase in importance for many central banks, unquote. The shift to the euro has big implications for the foreign exchange markets and the U.S. and European economies. Currency specialists say the yawning U.S. current account deficit, now at 5%, is bound to drive the dollar down further and the euro still higher over the next 2 to 4 years. Although the greenback may stage a short-term recovery once the looming war with Iraq is over, predictions are that it will then continue its downward trend and that central banks will play their part in the descent. Quote, even if central banks increase their euro holdings by just a few percent, it will have a major impact on the market, says Clowiter. We're talking many billions of dollars, unquote. If not deterred, OPEC could follow suit. Libya has been urging for some time that oil be priced in euros rather than dollars. Javad Yarjani, an Iranian senior OPEC official, told a European Union seminar in April of 2002 that despite the problems raised by such a conversion, quote, I believe that OPEC will not discount entirely the possibility of adopting euro pricing and payments in the future, unquote. Meanwhile, Hugo Chavez has been taking Venezuelan oil out of the petrodollar economy by bartering oil directly for commodities from 13 other third world countries. Although this has not yet qualified Venezuela for official membership in Bush's Axis of Evil, the heavy hand of the Bush administration in the recent coup attempt against Chavez was only too obvious. Continuing the conclusion of Professor Scott's article, I'm not going to read the entire thing. He argues for a dollar-euro parity. I think that, again, there's a lot of substance to what Peter Dale Scott is talking about here. I think that the overall situation vis-a-vis Iraq is more complicated than this, but this is an important element. It is not being discussed. To conclude, the Bush administration is not threatening Iraq out of pique or whim. The recent policies of both parties have indeed made the U.S. vulnerable to foreign oil and petrodollar pressures. But hopefully decent Americans will protest the notion that it is appropriate to rain missiles and bombs upon civilians of another country who have had little or nothing to do with this crisis of America's own making. Some, in addition, will continue to explore avenues whereby America's oil and financial vulnerabilities can be diminished without continuing down the road to Armageddon. These problems are serious, but economists have put forward proposals for diminishing them peacefully and multilaterally. This, by the way, is one of a number of elements here that motivated me to title this article, The War, The Day of the Cynics. With respect to oil, Ralph Nader has just written, quote, "The demand is simple. Stop this war before it starts and immediately establish a sane national energy security strategy," unquote. This from Ralph Nader. I think this is a great idea, and what I'd like to suggest is that multimillionaire Ralph Nader, not incidentally a beneficiary of the Bush tax cut policies, I'd like to suggest that Ralph Nader follow his advice by building a time machine, traveling back to the year 2000 and killing himself so that perhaps Bush would not win the election. Pearls of wisdom here from old shoplifter face. Again, about as cynical as anything I could think of. I think Ralph Nader's role in the 2000 campaign was critical. Al Gore was basically being attacked from the right and from the left, and when he defended himself from attacks from the right, it made him vulnerable from attacks from the left, and in effect it was a pincers movement. And again, I think that there is nothing more cynical than Ralph Nader complaining about the current situation, which he played a significant role in helping to create. Now, back to the issue of the struggle for the Earth Island, I'm going to reread a couple of sections from an article by Kevin Coogan. This is an article that I read in its entirety in, for the record, 377 and 378, and I'm going to reread a couple of sections from, for the record, 378. This is from a paper that is a summary analysis of some key sections of the book Schmutzige Geschäfte und Heiliger Krieg, that is, that translates Dirty Business and Holy War. It's about Al-Qaeda in Europe. It was co-authored by Germania and Johannes von Donani. And this is a couple of, I'm going to read a couple of Kevin Coogan's ruminations concerning Al-Qaeda, and in particular, one of the things that is a focal point of this particular paper concerns connections between the European far right and explicitly fascist elements and the Al-Qaeda milieu and the Muslim Brotherhood in particular. They're sort of the parent organization of Al-Qaeda and most of the Islamist and Islamo-fascist organizations. Again, this is a line of inquiry that I've been conducting for quite some time, and if listeners would like to examine the discussion of Kevin Coogan's analysis of the von Donani book, for the record 377 and for the record 378, both streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery, both available on CD from Spitfire, and there are long written descriptions of both broadcasts, which have in combination with For the Record 381, for all intents and purposes, have the entire Kevin Coogan summary analysis of Schmutzige Geschäfte und Heiliger Krieg. The text is reproduced in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. And the sections of Kevin Coogan's paper that I'm about to read are from For the Record 378. Quote, "My own belief is that it is less the apparently fantastic and James Bond-like quality of this analysis that is most difficult to understand. The real difficulty is the utter ignorance of most Westerners, Americans in particular, about the very existence of such people as François Genoux. Thus, when Ernest Backes, one of Europe's leading experts in money laundering, told the Luxembourg-based journal Plus Minus last year that he believed the financial source of funds for the September 11th terrorists would ultimately be traced back to Swiss bank accounts established by Genoux, few Americans had any idea what Backes could possibly be talking about." By the way, François Genoux was one of the most important Third Reich spies before, during, and after World War II. He was a key element of the Odessa Network. He had much to do with not only helping the escape of various Nazi war criminals and helping to oversee the Odessa Network in the post-World War II period, but also had a lot to do with the post-war dispersal of Nazi funds. He was also the heir to the literary works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels, and was also heavily involved with various Middle Eastern terrorist groups, including, and also far-left groups, including organizations like the Baader-Meinhof Gang, or Red Army Faction, that we're going to talk about in a minute, and various Middle Eastern groups such as the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and people like Carlos the Jackal. He also helped to finance the defense of Adolf Eichmann and also the defense of Klaus Barbie in the 1980s. And we've talked about François Genoux in many programs, including his connections to the Muslim Brotherhood and to the Iranian fundamentalist government and to the Al-Taqwa Network and people like Ahmed Huber. By the way, I would note that his good friend and lawyer, Baudin Dunant, is the co-chairman of the board of SICO, the Saudi investment company, which is the holding company that basically encompasses the and holds the assets for the various sections of the bin Laden economic empire. Continuing with Kevin Coogan's text, "For this same reason, there has been virtually no independent investigation into SICO's Baudin Dunant's relationship to Genoux, or for that matter, the role of Syrian-born Mohammed Mardam Bey, believed to be related to his former Syrian foreign minister, has played both as a member of Magnan Dunant Associates as well as Bey's possible links with Genoux. And what does it mean when we are told that Youssef Nada, for example, is believed by Egyptian authorities to have worked for German intelligence in World War II? It is not at all impossible that networks first developed in the 1930s and who saw their economic power fantastically multiplied in the wake of the enormous hike in oil prices in 1973 are now engaged in trying to enact a major financial shift away from the dollar and Anglo-American financial networks and to shift the vast wealth of the Muslim oil states into a new euro-based financial network that would vastly increase the power of those banks and financial interests in Europe associated with elements of far-right elites that survived World War II relatively intact," unquote. If this were at all the case, it would not be a new development. The very same attempt to develop an independent Saudi-German hookup to subvert the U.S. and British domination of the Saudi oil markets was actually attempted in the mid-1950s. At that time, the Saudi royal family, using the advice of the famous German banker Hjalmar Schacht, attempted to employ Aristotle Onassis to transport Saudi oil on new oil tankers that would be constructed in the shipyards of Germany. This attempt to break the Western oil control over Saudi Arabia was finally blocked by the United States, a story well documented in Jim Hogan's book Spooks. And later on in this, in For the Record 378, I included a section from Kevin Coogan's book, Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International. And here he discussed Hjalmar Schacht, who was the first finance minister of the Third Reich, and who also was very close to not only François Janoux, but also on the other side of the Atlantic, Alan Dulles, who along with British spy and Nazi double agent Jack Philby and King Ibn Saud was inextricably linked with the founding of Saudi Arabia, and in turn the Saudi bin Laden group was the founded at the very inception of Saudi Arabia. I would also note that Alan Dulles, in turn, was deeply involved with the Bush family's investments with the Third Reich. And Dulles himself was very, very close to the Bush family and to the interests that have evolved into the current administration. Now, of this, of what was called the Jeddah Agreement, in which Hjalmar Schacht was involved with a gambit which would have built a fleet of super tankers and which would have been instrumental in breaking the Seven Sisters Oil Company's hegemony over the distribution of Middle Eastern oil. And this, again, as is the case with the speculation that Kevin Coogan engaged in concerning the events of September 11th and the an aspect of this entire question that has not been examined by most observers, namely the connections between the far right and explicit fascist elements, including veterans of the Third Reich, and not only Al-Qaeda, but the Muslim Brotherhood. And this far right slash fascist Islamist link has been left out of almost all of the analyses of September 11th, and I believe that it is a central element of this geopolitical struggle. And indeed, I think that in the section I'm about to read from Kevin Coogan's book, Dreamer of the Day, one can see an element that in many ways anticipated the geopolitical and financial struggle that Professor Peter Dale Scott was talking about in that particular paper. This again from For the Record 378, and this text excerpt is actually printed in For the Record 378, and this in turn is from Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey in the Postwar Fascist International, from page 383. Another key figure involved in German intrigue in the Middle East was Hjalmar Schacht. He first came to Egypt as General Naguib's guest of honor after the coup against King Farouk. Schacht's most daring Middle East power play was the Jeddah Agreement between German industry and Saudi Arabia in January of 1954. Under the terms of the deal, Saudi Arabia agreed to establish a fleet of supertankers to be built in German shipyards that would carry Saudi oil around the world. Aristotle Onassis was chosen to manage the shipping side of the operation. Besides making the Ruhr industrialists fantastically wealthy, Jeddah threatened to break the Seven Sisters Oil Company's hegemony over the distribution of Middle East oil. The Jeddah Agreement was ultimately blocked by the Western oil cartel with help from the CIA. Yet Alan Dulles' CIA was surprisingly hesitant to confront Schacht. Robert Mayhew, one of the coordinators of the American attack on Jeddah, said of the CIA, quote, "You can't imagine how hard it was to convince them that the national interest was at stake," unquote. And as I added in a commentary on this, one wonders to what extent some of the Bush-related petroleum interests implicated in the background of the 9/11 attacks have proven similarly recalcitrant to the concept of the national interest. Now, again, this broadcast is titled The Day of the Cynics, and this is not to impugn the sincerity of the many people around the world who are horrified by the prospects of what could take place in the Middle East, but I think in terms of the French government's and the German government's role vis-a-vis Iraq, I think it is altogether cynical. First of all, I would note the profound German support for Saddam Hussein, including the equipping him with many of his weapons of mass destruction. I would also note that the very first act of the reunified Germany was basically to precipitate the Balkans War. I would also note that German role in September 11th has not received a lot of discussion. They had the Hamburg cell that was the epicenter for the attacks under electronic and physical surveillance by August of 1998, and yet no action was taken. Then they attempted to deflect blame to the United States, Britain, and Israel for intelligence failures, and there were certainly was some, not only intelligence failures, but compromising of U.S. intelligence in connection with September 11th, but the German role is very, very interesting indeed. And I would note that Joschka Fischer, the German foreign minister, is a former fellow traveler of the Baader-Meinhof gang, or Red Army faction, one of whose graduates, associates, Horst Mahler, is now one of the top functionaries of the NPD, the top German neo-Nazi party, along with Ahmed Huber of Al-Taqwa and the Muslim Brotherhood milieu. This is from the Washington Post of February 12th of 2003. It's an article by Michael Kelly talking about Joschka Fischer and his background as a fellow traveler of the Baader-Meinhof gang and Red Army faction, in turn associated with the aforementioned François Genoux, a running mate of, among others, Hjalmar Schacht, and one of the most important of the post-World War II German and underground Reich operatives. This op-ed column was titled Germany's Mr. Tough Guy. And one of Joschka Fischer's Red Army faction associates was a guy named Hans-Joachim Klein. In 2001, the German government put on trial your old friend Hans-Joachim Klein, who had been an underground, quote, soldier, unquote, in the revolutionary cells, an ally of the Red Army faction, and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. That, by the way, headed up by, among others, that was of George Haddad, and very close also to François Genoux. The revolutionary cells helped in the murder of the Israeli Olympic athletes in Munich in 1972, and Klein himself took part in a 1975 joint assassination operation with Carlos the Jackal, in which three were killed. During your testimony at Klein's trial, you were accused of having harbored Red Army faction members in your revolutionary struggle house, the Frankfurt Center for the group Revolutionary Struggle, which you co-founded with housemate Daniel Danny the Red Cohn-Bendit. You were forced to admit that there was some truth in the accusation after it was revealed, as Berman reported, that Margaret Schiller, quote, who had served jail time for her connections to the Red Army faction, unquote, had in her memoirs, again quoting, plainly stated that she had spent a few days in the early 1970s living in the Revolutionary Struggle house, unquote. In 1969, you attended the meeting of the Palestine Liberation Organization, in which the PLO resolved that its ultimate aim was the extinction of Israel, that is to say, the extinction or expulsion of the Jews of Israel, and goes on to talk about Joschka Fischer's association with this François Genoux-connected milieu. And again, I have long suspected that Fischer himself, despite his left-wing-slash-green heritage, might very well be a BND agent. He was the top sort of exponent of the German peace movement when Gorbachev was hesitating about German reunification, and then once the Balkans War was precipitated by Germany's forced breakup of the Yugoslav Federation, he metamorphosed into one of the top war drum beaters, so to speak, for the Balkans War. Likewise, I think France, whose corporations are controlled by Germany and who in turn has an historical relationship with Saddam Hussein's petroleum economy, I think, too, and this is not to impugn the sincerity of German and French citizens or American opponents of the war, but rather to note the cynicism of the institutions and the countries involved here. USA Today of February 27th of 2003 had an article by Vivienne Walt titled Chirac Plays to France's Powerful Past, and some of France's economic motivations and the history of these are noted in the following article. France has extensive trade deals with Iraq under a UN program that allows Baghdad to trade oil for food and humanitarian goods. The French oil company Total has signed several oil exploration deals with Iraq's government, and France is one of Iraq's biggest trading partners. It received about $700 million in revenue in 2001 from exports to Iraq. French car makers Renault and PSA Peugeot Citroën attended Baghdad's International Trade Fair last November. As prime minister in the 1970s, Chirac negotiated with Saddam to sell Iraq France's nuclear technology and 60 Mirage fighter jets. And one of those, some of that nuclear technology was the Osirak reactor. But I would note that Totofina ELF, in turn, was heavily involved with a CDU funding scandal and a very complex maneuvering which involved not only ThyssenKrupp, one of the core German corporations, also with an historical relationship to both the Third Reich and to the Bush family, and also Bertelsmann, and again, it was heavily involved with a very complex program about which I've done a number of broadcasts, a very complex event about which I've done a number of programs, the CDU funding scandal. For the record, 294, and for the records, 276 and 278 go into the CDU funding scandal, that among other programs. One of the things that is worth noting is that many people, and the CIA has concurred with this analysis, is that a U.S. military adventure into Iraq might very well exacerbate the conflict with al-Qaeda, certainly drawing off resources and quite possibly heading recruits in the direction of al-Qaeda. The CIA has also noted that Saddam Hussein is most likely to give weapons to terrorists if, in fact, his existence is threatened. Note the following story, this from the San Jose Mercury News of Tuesday, February 25th of 2003. This is by Philip Smucker. It's Dateline Damascus, Syria, headlined, Al-Qaeda stands to gain from war, analysts say. It reads in part as follows. Osama bin Laden is likely to gain support and foot soldiers should the U.S. military lead an invasion of Iraq, warn leading counterterrorism experts and a senior U.S. intelligence official. The analysts, whose view that the al-Qaeda terror network stands to gain from a U.S. intervention, are disputed by Defense Department and White House officials who say that bin Laden has tailored several recent audio messages to fit with long-standing Arab fears of Western military domination. Quote, Bin Laden is a dreadfully talented player, unquote, said a U.S. intelligence analyst who is the anonymous author of the book Through Our Enemy's Eyes, an account of bin Laden's network and views. Quote, He remains focused on three things that have the support, I think, of most Muslims, whether they're liberal or conservative. Many disagree with his tactics and actions, but almost no one disagrees with him that the U.S. should get its forces out of Saudi Arabia and sanctions on Iraq and lean on the Israelis about their treatment of the Palestinians. Skipping down, the U.S. official who spoke from Virginia on the condition that he remain unidentified said that bin Laden probably believes current U.S. interventionist policies strongly favor his own designs. And as I've indicated in the past, I think that the Bush administration is playing into the hands of the underground Reich, and I think that key elements of this administration are in fact a fifth column for the underground Reich. I think Bush himself is simply after greed and oil. There's motivated by greed and oil, not to mention a lack of diplomatic skill. I think others, in fact, are looking to destroy the United States, either economically, certainly diplomatically, and perhaps physically as well through terrorist acts. More, I've talked about that in past programs. Also, frankly, I think that the Bush administration is seeking to distract from the fact that he has no domestic agenda other than simply cutting taxes on the wealthy and screwing everybody else. I think that the cynicism of this administration could not be exaggerated, as well as the cynicism of the French and the Germans in this. And again, I'm talking about the countries and their institutions. At the same time that Bush is sending our soldiers off to war, he's basically using the military, much like Captain Ahab used the harpooners to chase after Moby Dick to their ultimate destruction. At the same time as Bush is waving the flag and beating the war drums, he's eliminated a program of long standing in which U.S. veterans got military care, medical care, excuse me, for the rest of their lives. He is also now moving to slash federal support to the school children of people in the military. Two very, very cynical maneuvers indeed. I'm going to conclude by another example of the day of the cynics. This from the book Blinded by the Right by David Brock, just out in paperback by Three Rivers Press. One of the leading advocates of the Republican far right is Ann Coulter, the author of the book Slander. And this is about as cynical as anything I've ever heard. Speaking of Ann Coulter, she left her job as a commentator on MSNBC after telling a disabled Vietnam veteran in a debate, quote, people like you caused us to lose the war, unquote. That's surreal. No doubt if Ann Coulter had been walking point through the Iron Triangle and trading tracer with the NVA's Tiger Division and calling in airstrikes from the Texas Air National Guard, that would have carried the day. Last but certainly not least, in the Cynics column, we have Ramsey Clark heading up the organization Answer. Ramsey Clark helped cover up the murders of both Kennedys and Martin Luther King, and some of Answer's marches against the war were on the Martin Luther King holiday weekend, and the organization is led by the Attorney General who covered up Martin Luther King's assassination. The Day of the Cynics, indeed. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record 401, The Day of the Cynics, being recorded on March 3rd of the year 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.